Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we normally pass judgment on all the kings and emperors of France from Clovis to Napoleon III, but today we're doing something a little different.
Who will be selected as the Supreme Regent? And who will fall victim to the madness?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
I loved how you
that was...
You lay the Supreme Regent. You reminded me of the Elmo meme where there's like flames behind him.
I felt so I had to do it very dramatically, be like,
you just suddenly transformed into that. So yeah, before we get into the special mini-series, which will have a slightly different format to the episodes we've had before, Eliza, how was your summer?
Yeah, it was nice. I went to Hokkaido, which was amazing. Getting to escape from the humidity of mainland Japan is always a good bonus.
My summer's been like the craziest, least relaxing one I've ever had. I went to America and then I was like working for all of August and like my parents came to Edinburgh. It was like a lot of things happening. But now things are settling down and I can get back to podcast stuff.
Nice.
Which is excellent. So before we dive into this special mini-series we're doing, The Regency of Madness, mm-hmm. I've got to explain to both Eliza and the listener why we are doing this and sort of why we are deviating from our format and why we aren't just going straight to Joan of Arc.
You mean straight to the king?
Yeah, but also Joan of Arc is, like, I feel like, you know, she's the one people are waiting for.
Maybe for you, I'm waiting for the king, my favorite
That's
one.
That's true. So before we get to the king, King Charles VI, or Joan of Arc, that'll definitely be the climax of the Hundred Years' War. But there's a lot of history for us to cover first, and a lot of people in the period leading up to that that could be considered rulers or co-rulers of France in their own way. Mm. And this is because not only do we begin the reign of our next king, Charles VI, with a minority, so he becomes king when he's 11 years old, but we also get an extended regency council situation due to a number of psychotic episodes he unfortunately suffers throughout his life. Mm. Spoiler alert, this is the so-called Charles the Mad. But not only that, but we also have English people claiming to rule France, of course.
Of course.
And within France itself, we've got a civil war with different factions claiming to be the rightful regent. Mm. And on top of that, we have like other outsiders trying to gain control over the French military and like French power centers. So the result of this is that I've compiled quite a lengthy list of people who could be considered some kind of regent or semi-regent in this very confused, chaotic period. Mm-hmm. I managed to narrow them down to the 10 most interesting and significant people, but 10 full length episodes is a lot for a bunch of people who aren't really king. So instead, each episode is going to be sort of killing two birds with one stone. So we're doing 5 episodes.
Nice.
Where we tell the parallel stories of 2 separate people. And then at the end of the episode, we'll pit them against each other.
And I get to decide all by myself.
Each category, instead of giving them a rating, it will be me and a guest being like, this is how this person showed the qualities of this particular category. So if it's like En Garde, it's like, this is how they... fought battles and gained power and stuff like that. And then Eliza will be the arbitrator. So Eliza will decide who won the round. So we're not giving anyone a rating.
I hold the power.
It'll simply be Eliza deciding, did this person...
Who she likes more.
is this person better at this particular category? Yeah. And to make this extra interesting and special, we're of course inviting on a guest each episode. Mm-hmm. But wait, there's more. To wrap up this mini tournament that we're calling the Regency of Madness, we'll put up an online poll so that listeners can decide who out of the 5 finalists will be declared the Supreme Regent and get a place in the VIP box at the tournament.
Nice.
So there'll be one ultimate regent that you guys get to decide. So it'll be a mixture of Eliza deciding it and you guys deciding it.
Me deciding the finalists.
Yeah, and my hands are off the wheel for this one. Apart from the fact that I'm writing the episodes and organizing the guests and doing all the
doing
work.
Everything.
Yes.
And I just get to listen and, you know.
Exactly. So our guests will include Veronica Fortune from the past podcast. Katie and Nathan from the Queen's Podcast. And for today's episode, we're having on Josh Zucker from the Grand Dukes of the West podcast. We've already recorded that, but yeah, it was a very fun time.
Yes.
So his podcast is all about the Valois Dukes of Burgundy. So naturally, he'll be talking about the first Valois Duke of Burgundy, who is Philip the Bold, the uncle of Charles VI, who was one of the most prominent, if not the most prominent, regent in the early regency. Meanwhile, in my corner, I've got his rival, Duke Louis of Orléans, the king's brother, who is going to be in sort of direct competition with his uncle, both for the regency and for Eliza's heart, more importantly.
Yes.
So we'll get into the episode in just a moment, but first I have to thank some patrons.
Yes.
Yes. So joining us over the summer, we've had, in Economy Plus, we've had Sophie Knoll. We've had Alexis Mayer, and we've had Megan Boyer.
Yay.
And then in way back in the nosebleed section, we've had Johan Ask. Nice. So welcome to
our
lovely patrons. And now, without further ado, now that we know what we're doing, we're going to do it.
Let's begin.
So thank you, Josh, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Josh does the Grand Dukes of the West podcast, covering all of the Valois Dukes of Burgundy, who just so happened to start with one of the people that we're talking about today, or rather the person that Josh is taking the side of today.
Go Philip.
Philip, yes. So Philip the Bold, Philip the Actually Bold, as I call him, because we had an earlier French king called Philip the Bold who was more like foolish than bold.
My Philip does launch an abortive crusade as well, so there's that.
God. There is that. We'll get to that. yes, yeah, so my person is Louis of Orléans. So basically, we're doing two dukes who were vying for power, I suppose. Duking it out, exactly. During the reign of Charles VI, who is a king that Eliza already knows like a little bit about. So yeah. You'll be able to maybe help us out at certain points in this episode.
Oh, I just know like interesting, scandally things that happened about him, really.
We'll very much get to that.
We're going to be getting all of these regents out of the way, and then that will climax, I guess, in us finally getting to Charles and reigning Charles.
Yeah.
So Louis of Orléans is Charles VI's brother, his younger brother, whereas Philip the Bold is the younger brother of his father, so his uncle. So as a result, Philip the Bold is the one who is born first. So Josh will go first. But first we have to do a like a big old asterisk about how
that happened.
Regencies are a bit of a tricky thing to define in this period, in the reign of Charles VI. So Josh, since you're the resident expert on this period, can you give us a very brief overview about why this king has so many regents and why it's hard to really even define who's a regent and who's not?
Of course. So as you know, Charles V's ulcer dried up and he died relatively young. So Charles VI came to the throne as a child. He was dominated by his uncles while he was still a child. But, you know, that's just what you do with a child king. And everyone knew that the arrangement would be temporary. In 1388, he started his period of personal rule, which only lasted for 4 years. During that time, he left most of the governing of the kingdom to a group of advisors who had served his father. These were known as the Marmosets by Froissart. And the period ended up being honestly pretty similar to the time when Charles V ruled. Because, you know, a lot of the same men were in charge.
The same people, a.k.a. the smart people who did all the reforms that we liked in Charles V's episode.
Yay!
Yes. A nice break from the a new king takes over and executes all of his father's old
opinions. Yeah, he's doing one thing right so far.
They're still, like, definitely, like, nobility, but they're, like, the skilled nobility.
Nice.
Yeah, they're,
not
like...
just the people who are directly related to the king.
They're middling and minor nobles for the most part. They were called the Marmosets or the Little Men, but that was really just when you're comparing it to, like, the royal princes.
I like Marmosets. That's a great name.
The little monkeys. Well, none of the Marmosets, sadly, are big enough to get an episode, so... Sorry to the Marmosets.
We'll remember them in our hearts because of their adorable name. Literally, they could be incompetent, and I would still love them because of the name.
This is the arbitrator that we've decided to pick to determine.
So you guys better give them some really good nicknames and epithets because that will determine it.
We're already off to a good start.
Anyway, so the rule of the Marmosets was cut short because in 1392, Charles VI was struck by the first episode of a mental illness that would... basically continue off and on for the rest of his life.
No.
More on than off. Jonathan Sumption, who wrote this great big series on the Hundred Years' War, puts it in a way that I really like, so I'm going to read what he wrote.
Yeah.
For France, the political consequences of his mental illness were catastrophic, far worse than they would have been if Charles had died. So long as the king lived, everything had to be done in his name. The situation was too uncertain to warrant a formal regency, which might have provided a measure of continuity and conserved the strength of the Valois monarchy. Instead, power was uneasily contested between his closest relatives and was exercised intermittently by cliques with no real legitimacy in law or security in fact.
So it was mafia rules.
Yeah.
He was kind of a puppet king, I guess.
Oh, yes.
His episodes of mental illness were diplomatically known as his absences. And when he was absent, there wasn't a really strict rule of what to do.
Like who would take over?
Yeah, for the most part, the royal council ran things. And so that became a big battleground between rival factions.
Yeah, bickering.
And then, you know, depending on the age of the Dauphin, sometimes the Dauphin was able to wield royal authority. Sometimes the queen had power, sometimes she didn't, depending on who else was working at the time.
Yeah, we'll get to it in later episodes, but there are several Dauphins who succeed one another. but we will get to them in future episodes. They're not quite old enough by the end of this episode.
Yeah. A good example of why you need an heir and a spare and a spare.
Yes.
There were a few attempts to create a regency, but no agreement or consensus could ever be reached. Charles would make a plan, and then someone would come to him, and he would undo it.
Oh, golly gosh.
And then when he was present, he resumed his duties, but he was still tired and easily influenced. And basically, the big difference was that now the political squabbles would happen for his attention, as opposed to just happening on the royal council.
So it's kind of like, oh my god, with the concubines, and they're like, choose me, sire.
Yeah.
The squabbles are usually occurring between two distinct factions, which we will see materialize in this episode.
Okay.
Who may or may not be started by the two figures that we're talking about.
We do see a third faction emerge a little bit, led by the Dauphin, but I'll leave that for another episode for you guys.
Yeah, because what we needed was more factions.
Yeah.
You never have enough.
Should we start with Philip the Bold then?
So since, you know, Philip of Burgundy is the uncle, he's older, we will start off with his early life. So take it away, John. Réveillez-vous, Picard, Picard, c'est pour rien. Et trouvez la manière d'avoir de bons bastons. Car ici le printemps, c'est aussi la saison. Pour aller à la bouée, donner des orions.
So Philip the Bold was born to John II, John the Good, who at the time was the Duke of Normandy, on January the 17th, 1342. So he's born to John and his wife Bonne of Bohemia, who was the daughter of the King of Bohemia, John the Blind, who famously went off into battle blind and did not come out.
Still boss move there.
And John II, if you remember, is the king who ends up in English captivity two separate times.
Him! Yeah, I totally forgot about it. Like, I remember him, but I don't remember his name. But, oh, he was one who just wanted a holiday. Yeah.
Well, according to your speculation.
Okay, come on. That second time is definitely a holiday.
I actually do agree with her there. Yeah. I think she's right on the money.
This is an excuse for me to have a rest.
So that actually does bring us to the first, like, major event in Philip's life. It's the Battle of Poitiers. He was only 14 at the time.
Damn.
And initially, all of John's sons were actually at the battle, but they were sent away halfway through. Philip was the only one to return to his father's side, and he stayed even when things began to turn against the French king.
Is he the one who got captured?
Yes. Oh, okay. So in the last desperate phase of the fighting, Philip's, like, standing by his father's side. He has a sword, and he's parrying sword blows coming towards the king. He's shouting, "Father to the left, father to the right," you know, making sure his dad doesn't get killed. And so finally, John receives word that if he doesn't surrender now, he's just going to be overtaken and killed. Mm. So he surrendered, and him and Philip together spent the next few years in England as very well-treated prisoners. And I believe they spent a good amount of time in the Black Prince's household.
Nice.
And there's even stories that come down where Philip learned to play chess with the Black Prince.
Aww.
The Black Prince, if you recall, he was very, like, respectful, yeah, very deferential to his French prisoners. He even hired a minstrel to cheer up the King of France at one point because he was depressed.
Oh, yeah.
Also, from his exploits at the battle, that's how Philip the Bold ends up being called Philip the Bold.
Nice.
Yeah. All the Burgundians will have pretty good nicknames, and three of them do earn them in battle. So yeah, Philip returns to France a few years later in 1360 with the Treaty of Brittany. Mm. During that time, you might remember Dauphin Charles running around dealing with all of these problems.
Yeah.
Just imagine Philip the Bold, you know, at banquets in England playing chess and learning to hunt.
And he's
Very different experience for the two princes.
And the Treaty of Brittany is the one to remember, because the Treaty of Brittany is, like, devastating for France.
Yeah.
It's when England takes over, like
a chunk of it.
Basically 2/3 of the country. Yeah, a whole big chunk. And this is a treaty that the English are going to constantly refer back to be like, because once France regains a lot of that land, the English are going to be like, we want to go back to Brittany, basically. So that's the significance of Brittany.
The thing that I really appreciate about the English response to the Treaty of Brittany is that, like, decades later, they're going to be mad at the French for not paying the rest of John the Good's ransom, even though he died in English captivity.
Yeah, it's like, that's on you.
God.
And that brings us to John the Good giving all of his sons some appanages, or areas, basically, to keep up their lifestyle. His second oldest son, Louis, gains Anjou and Maine, I believe. His third oldest son, John, gains Berry. And Philip does not get Burgundy at this point. He gets Touraine, which is the region centered around the city of Tours. It's a relatively modest one when compared to the appanages that his brothers got.
Yeah.
And definitely when you compare it to Burgundy itself, which was one of the richest duchies in France at the time.
Did he know he was going to get Burgundy?
So in 1360, probably not, because in 1360, we have good reason to believe that Philip the Bold was John's favorite son.
Yeah.
And he probably did expect that he would be getting more in the future, if not Burgundy itself.
Yeah.
In 1361, however, Philip of Rouve, who is the last Capetian Duke of Burgundy, he died. Probably from the plague, but possibly from falling off of a horse.
Of course.
He was, I think, either a child or a young teenager at the time.
Aww.
And so he had no children. So it kind of created a succession dispute in the Duchy of Burgundy. And the two main claimants were John the Good and Charles the Bad.
So this is something that I got wrong on the podcast, and which you, Josh, actually pointed out that I got it wrong. I got wrong, like, the reason that John was able to claim it. I just assumed it was like a Salic law kind of thing, where John was like, I'm the most senior Capetian, so I should get it.
Yeah.
But it's actually through, both of these claims are through a female line.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Everyone's been marrying their cousins over the centuries, so everyone's related.
So John's mother was Margaret of Burgundy, and Charles's grandmother was Joan of Burgundy, who is Margaret of Burgundy's older sister. So the main debate was, do we follow primogeniture inheritance or proximity of blood inheritance?
Mm.
And actually, in Burgundy, it wasn't like a hard and fast rule, but the general rule was to follow primogeniture.
Huh.
But Charles the Bad had flirtations with the English. Mm. He was a big fan of using free companies or these bands of mercenaries that would, yeah, like, run around pillaging things all over the place.
And Charles the Bad had a strong claim on the French throne as well, because his mother was Joan II of Navarre, who'd been passed over.
Mm.
I should be king. I should be Duke of Burgundy. Rah, rah.
Mm.
But so, yeah, a lot of people in Burgundy did not like Charles the Bad. And to make things even worse for Charles's case, John II was also married to Philip of Rouve's mother after both of their first spouses died.
Mm.
And he had been actually regent of the duchy for a few years. So John was known and liked in Burgundy, while Charles was known and disliked in Burgundy. Mm. So the nobles of Burgundy did agree to make John their duke, but on the condition that the duchy would not be absorbed by the crown.
Yeah.
So in 1363, John is like, okay, I have this duchy that it has to be separate from the royal domain, and my favorite son is only the Duke of Touraine. Poor him.
Yeah.
So he makes Philip his lieutenant in Burgundy, and I'm not sure why, but he was also secretly made duke. He wasn't publicly made duke until the next year.
Random.
But the first year of his rule, he's only the secret Duke of Burgundy.
Oh, I love that. secret duke.
And so Philip becomes publicly the Duke of Burgundy. You know, Louis of Anjou comes back to France. He walks out the door, as I think you put it. And
he walks. Yes, I remember that.
That's my favorite.
John goes and takes his vacation and then immediately dies, basically. So Charles V, as one of his first acts of king, he says, okay, you are Duke of Burgundy officially now. Philip also was made first peer of the realm, which basically, when you ignore all of the status that, you know, being related to the king gives you, and you're just looking at noble rankings after that, mm-hmm, he's basically the chief noble.
The top dog.
And he was also made royal lieutenant in a whole bunch of eastern France, including large portions of Champagne, and other smaller lands that I don't know off the top of my head. Basically, Philip is a super important guy in eastern France now. However, Charles the Bad still wants Burgundy. He wants to be king. He wants to be Duke of Burgundy. You know, he's been usurped once again, at least from his point of view. So he organized an army of free companies. He planned a campaign into Normandy and a campaign into Burgundy. But as the Norman campaign was just getting going, and before he could launch the second wave of his attack into Burgundy, he was met by Bertrand du Guesclin, who you definitely brought him up in the Charles V episode.
Yeah, we talked about him. He's like the random Breton guy that emerges from the woods.
Yeah, him.
Yeah, and then he just suddenly, like, Charles makes him his, like, marshal, and then he just suddenly manages to defeat a bunch of people, including the English, including Charles the Bad.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the defeats. Charles gets defeated and he is no longer a threat to Burgundy. However, while Charles wasn't a threat to Burgundy, the free companies that he hired still were sticking around the duchy. Mm. And so they're at one point they plan to kidnap and hold Philip for ransom. They're taking castles, taking towns, disrupting trade. Philip spends a lot of his early time in Burgundy just trying to figure out how to deal with them.
Mm.
The biggest threat that the free companies pose kind of goes away once the Hundred Years' War gets going in 1369, because all of a sudden these out-of-work mercenaries have work.
Yeah.
But there are cases of free companies remaining in the duchy and causing havoc going into the 1380s. So they stick around for a long time, yeah. And they cause a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. I think I've routinely called these guys the routiers on the podcast because yeah. I just like that word.
Oh, yeah, that is a good one.
But yeah, routiers, free companies. They're also called the latecomers sometimes because basically they show up late for wars and then they just kind of hang around.
Yeah, at one point Philip tries to send them on crusade, but then the crusade falls apart. There's a whole list of ways that Philip tried to deal with them. Eventually, you know, he just builds a bunch of walls and castles and hopes for the best.
Makes sense.
A viable solution in the 14th century to build a wall. Not so viable in the 21st century.
Yeah.
Just so we know.
Yeah, siege warfare, however, will be getting a lot better with some early gunpowder weapons in the next few stages of the Hundred Years' War, though, so look out for that.
Look out for that, and how the French finally trump the English longbows with that, but that's in the future.
So the next big thing that Philip does is also in 1369, and that's getting married. So let's go back a little bit and look at Margaret of Flanders. She was the only legitimate child of Count Louis of Mahle, who is the Count of Flanders. Margaret was not only his only heir, he was also his mother's heir, who was yet another Margaret, Margaret of Burgundy, but other Burgundy.
Oh dear, here we go.
She was the Countess of Burgundy and Artois.
Eliza, remember how there were like seven princesses that got passed over when the Capetians ended? This is one of them.
Oh, okay.
She's like one of the children of, I think it's Philip the...
Fifth, I think.
Yeah, Philip the Fifth. Yeah, she's one of the children of Philip.
Oh, okay.
And granddaughter of Mao.
And your listeners should know that Flanders was a very independent-minded county. And not only was it a part of France, but it had very important ties trade-wise and even politically to England. So when the thought, King Charles V and Edward III looked at Flanders and saw, you know, a daughter that was going to inherit, they both said, we need this county in our royal family.
Yes.
So Edward III put out one of his sons. And Charles V put forward Philip the Bold. Louis of Mahle was kind of weighing both options. And when he was maybe looking to go for the English match, Margaret of Burgundy, she goes to him and she takes a knife in one hand and her breast in the other. And she exclaims, since you refuse to obey the wishes of your king and your mother, I intend, in order to shame you, to cut off this breast, which fed you and no one else, and throw it to the dogs.
Damn!
I love this.
After that dramatic exchange, Louis decides, okay, I'll go with Philip. Margaret also did threaten to disinherit him, so maybe, you know, he's like, man, I really want Artois and Burgundy. So that could be a two, but I personally prefer the first story. But anyways, the younger Margaret ends up getting married to Philip the Bold. And so now not only is he the Duke of Burgundy, which is a rich duchy all on its own, he's now set to inherit one of the most richest and urbanized and most volatile parts of Europe, which is the County of Flanders, as well as the counties of Artois, Burgundy, Nevers, and Rethel.
Nice.
So he is a very important man right now. And we're not even, like, approaching how powerful he gets.
So he's basically just got this big, massive blob around, like, northeastern France and also middle, central eastern France.
And so the 1370s, like I said, he's dealing with the free companies, and he's also dealing with the Hundred Years' War, which is back on. This part of the war is, you know, King Charles being all triumphant, being all chessboard, sending mostly Bertrand du Guesclin and Louis of Anjou out to go fight his battles for him.
Good times.
Philip was kind of a secondary player in all of this, but he was still important. He led a bunch of campaigns against English-held castles in Picardy and Normandy, as well as a few attacks against the King of Navarre. And he also made his way to Brittany a few times. And so that's what Philip is doing throughout the 1370s. Où est ce duc d'Autriche? Il est aux Pays-Bas. Il tomba sur Flandres avec ses picards. Qui nuit et jour le brillant, qui lève
that we've reached the 1370s, it's time for my guy to be born.
Woo!
The 13th of March, 1372, a boy called Louis is born to Charles V and Joan of Bourbon, his wife. Joan of Bourbon is the one who kind of suffers a bit from a mental illness that seems to kind of get passed to her son.
Yeah.
They're also like quite close cousins as well. So this is just not a great situation overall. But Louis's good. Louis's a healthy baby boy, one of the few healthy children that's born to them. I think actually Louis and Charles VI are the only two surviving children from this couple out of the many children that they
have. I think that's right. Yeah.
So they don't even have any sisters. It's just the two of them.
Relying on each other.
Yeah, and they're quite... They're fairly close in age as well.
They have a good relationship.
Yeah, they do. We'll get into it, but it generally seems like they definitely do. And around the age of two, Louis gets betrothed to a prestigious foreign princess, Catherine of Hungary, who is actually the heiress of Hungary. So like Philip, he's getting betrothed to
this woman
who's going to inherit quite a lot. So I guess the idea is that, you know, Charles can have his kingdom in France. Louis can go off have his own kingdom in Hungary. But sadly, Catherine died 4 years later as a young girl. So
that didn't
end up happening. No. Louis I of Hungary, the king of Hungary, he actually has two other daughters. So they aim to get the second daughter, Mary, married to the French prince. But she's already betrothed to Sigismund of Bohemia. So he's a cousin of Louis because he's from that same family, the Bohemia family from like John the Blind.
And actually, speaking of everyone being related, Louis of Hungary is an Angevin, so he's descended from Anjou.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so this is not the Anjou that we're going to be talking about in this episode, but this is like from a previous Anjou family, the ones that go off and conquer like Sicily and Hungary and like a bunch of other places in to the east and the south. Yes. The descendants of Charles of Anjou who went off adventuring and conquered a bunch of stuff. So Mary is like going to be the last heiress of this house. She's supposed to marry Sigismund of Bohemia. And by the way, the Bohemians also control Luxembourg, which is right next to France as well. But the French are like, nah, we were told that our guy got to marry the heiress. So then there's a dispute, which is not helped by the fact that the French appeal to Pope Clement VII in Avignon, while Hungarian nobility who support Sigismund appeal to Pope Urban VI in Rome. Because remember, we've got two popes at this point. And this eventually leads to Sigismund leading a Bohemian invasion of Hungary in order to gain Mary's hand by force. And there's not much that Louis of Orleans can do about it, because at that point he's only 13, while Sigismund is still a teenager as well, but an older teenager. So he can you know, bully him pretty well, and he can lead armies. So unfortunately, there's not much Louis can do about that. So Louis unfortunately misses out on a really good inheritance he might have had elsewhere. We'll see eventually he gets given, surprise, surprise, the Duchy of Touraine, which is the same little duchy that Philip had gotten as a boy and hadn't wanted.
And Louis will trade it, and surprise, surprise, Touraine will also go to a younger son of Charles VI eventually.
It's just getting passed around like a hot potato.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, Tours is like a really nice area. It's in the Loire Valley. It's like, it's cute.
Apparently not. But I guess it's nice not enough.
Profitable.
Yeah. It's just cute.
Yeah. It's a nice place to hang out if you're not, I guess, the son of a king.
Although eventually there'll be some really nice palaces built there, but that's in the future. With like Diana Poitiers.
A medieval son of the king, I guess.
Francois.
Yeah.
Yeah. They all build lovely palaces there. But anyway, back to wars.
So a little after this is happening in 1379, Louis of Flanders, not of Orléans, he's involved in a conflict between the Flemish cities of Ghent and Bruges. He decides to side with Bruges and arrests a leader of the Ghent militia. However, by doing this, he really overreached his authority. And this outraged Ghent, and it actually also made a lot of people in Bruges mad. Because by arresting a citizen of Ghent, he was kind of trampling all over the rights that cities had. So Ghent soon rose up into rebellion, and a lot of the more radical factions in the other cities, mostly artisans and specifically weavers. The cloth industry is really big in Flanders, so the weavers tend to be both the biggest and the most radical of the guilds. They all rise up throughout Flanders. And basically the whole of the county is in revolt. Philip is brought in. He helps to negotiate a settlement. I think, you know, he negotiates between Louis and the towns of Flanders every day for like a month straight. A settlement does get reached where Louis has to agree to give up some of his power to the three biggest towns of Flanders. So that's Ghent, Bruges, and Ypres. And, you know, everything seems good, but then the next year Ghent decides, you know what, let's revolt again. But we'll return to that in a little bit.
Yeah, the Flanders revolting is maybe going to be an ongoing thing that just happens in the background all the time.
Yeah. So, I'm feeling a bit bored today. Oh, let's revolt.
They should just be their own country, but that's just not the way it is in the Middle Ages. So shortly after the Ghent War in 1380, Charles V dies. So Charles VI's dad. So the throne passes to Charles VI, who's 11 years old at the time. The idea is for the realm to be governed jointly by his four uncles.
Yeah.
So this is Charles V's brothers, the Dukes of Anjou, Burgundy, and Berry, as well as his brother-in-law, the Duke of Bourbon. So Charles VI's uncle on his mother's side.
Yeah.
All of these guys are going to get episodes in the Regency of Madness, except for the first guy, Anjou, because his regency doesn't last very long.
And so initially, Anjou is actually like the chief regent.
Oh, damn.
There was technically only going to be one regent who was Anjou, while Berry, Burgundy, and Bourbon.
Like advisors.
Yeah, they would act as guardians of the young king and have an advisory role. Charles's old ministers would run most of the day-to-day affairs of the kingdom. And they would kind of, they wouldn't like directly oversee the princes, but it was kind of implied that they would have some power to direct affairs and make sure that the princes didn't try and grab too much power. However, Anjou decides that he wants to be like total regent. He wants to rule the kingdom. Mm. And so he attempts to seize more power for himself. And that kind of opens the floodgates. Burgundy does the same, and the other uncles are also, you know, trying to get some power now. And so the other uncles kind of unite against Anjou, and after some squabbling back and forth, which does include Philip the Bold pushing Louis of Anjou out of the chair next to the king during his coronation, because Philip said that you're in my seat. I'm first peer of the realm. I don't care if you're regent. That's my seat.
Oh my God, I love that.
So after all that happens, a regency council is formed. And Anjou does get to be president of the regency council, but he has significantly less power than he would have had under the initial arrangement if he hadn't tried to, you know, seize everything for himself.
Greedy.
But the first few years of Charles VI's reign do see Anjou as basically, he's running things for the most part, but now he has to share more power with his brothers.
But it doesn't go so well. Like, he already didn't have a great reputation because he'd been his brothers. While all of this stuff with Philip the Bold was going on, while Charles V was doing his thing, Anjou was mainly looking at the south of France, and he was mainly sort of acting as the king's right hand there.
Yeah.
He overtaxed the hell out of the people of the south of France, and the people of Languedoc hated Anjou, and the people of Paris, they weren't too keen to get the same treatment, and like, sure enough, Anjou came in with lots of high taxes. The people of Paris, as the people of Paris do, got really mad very, very quickly. And they even lynched some tax collectors during an uprising. And then south of France also went into full-scale revolt as well. But by this point, Anjou, you know, he's fed up with his brothers. He's fed up with the people of France. He's thinking, you know what? I'm sick of you all. I'm going to leave and get my own kingdom somewhere else.
Adios.
So Anjou decides, I'm gonna pull a Charles of Anjou, like my predecessor, and see if I can be king of Sicily.
Oh, God.
This isn't as crazy as it might at first sound. The queen of Sicily before Anjou, it has a queen, Joanna I of Naples, who's quite a formidable queen. And she is sort of the last scion of the other Anjou family, the ones that rule Sicily. So we've got, you know, those Anjous, they're ending in both Hungary and Sicily with a woman. So Joanna has some civil wars with her cousin, Charles of Durazzo, who's basically a giant asshole.
Yes.
And he was her heir. Yeah. And she basically tried to disinherit him by adopting Anjou as her successor. Basically just purely out of hatred.
It is fair, though. Yeah. He is kind of the worst.
And this ends not well for Joanna, unfortunately. She gets captured by Durazzo and assassinated in prison.
Ooh.
So Anjou then leaves France to claim his inheritance, the Kingdom of Naples. He manages to claim Provence, which is has, you know, historically been the part of mainland France that Sicily kind of controls. And he's actually crowned by Pope Clement VII in Avignon. And then he gathers an army of 40,000 for like this huge expedition to reclaim Naples from Durazzo with the help of the Count of Savoy. Durazzo, meanwhile, hires the 14,000 strong company of John Hawkwood, who's an English mercenary, and they win using sort of guerrilla tactics. Yeah. So like, to cut a long story short, eventually the Count of Savoy, Anjou's ally, he falls ill, he dies, his troops abandon Anjou, and Anjou himself follows a few months later on the 20th of September, 1384, while he's still waiting for reinforcements from France. Mm. So that's the end of Anjou. He sort of leaves, dies very quickly. So that is why we're not talking about Anjou, because it's not a very long story. So meanwhile, the other three uncles, they were left to see out the rest of Charles VI's minority, which brings us back to Philip of Burgundy, and specifically to his rise to power as the regent of France.
Yeah, so when Anjou left, you know, there were still three uncles fighting for power. But Philip was clearly the first among equals. Bourbon was more distantly related to the royal family. Technically, he was, I believe, the great-great-grandson of St. Louis, whereas Philip the Bold and John, Duke of Berry, were both sons of the king. And then when Louis left, Berry kind of became the head guy in charge of the south. Philip tended to be in charge around Paris and then the north of France. And that kind of makes sense, you know, Burgundy's in the north, I guess kind of central, but north when you kind of look at how France tends to be divided more politically.
Well, Flanders is definitely in the north, so he's definitely spending a lot of time up there.
And yes, definitely Flanders. There's a bunch of tax revolts going on. Two biggest ones are the Arelle in Normandy and the Mailleton in Paris. The Mailleton is called that because Parisian rioters broke into this warehouse and they stole a bunch of mallets. And they were just smashing a bunch of stuff.
I'm not surprised by any of the behavior of Parisians.
Absolutely. So Philip the Bold and Charles VI are on their way to go put down the revolt in Rouen, which is where the Arelle revolt was taking place, which Rouen is the capital of Normandy. And like basically as they're leaving the area around Paris, they receive word that the Mailleton revolt broke out. So they just have to turn around and march back to Paris immediately.
Of course.
This revolt doesn't end up getting put down by force. There is some force, you know, some companies of soldiers are sent into the city. But for the most part, the middle class kind of took control of the situation. They were getting freaked out by the poor people smashing a bunch of stuff with hammers. They managed to negotiate a settlement. So with that revolt put down, they once again are marching to Rouen, and once the royal army shows up, the Arelle rioters kind of just give in and submit to the king. Again, there are other more minor revolts breaking out, but those kind of are put down on a local level. However, during all of these revolts, the radical townspeople are chanting, "Ghent, Ghent, Ghent."
Oh, Winston.
Winston agrees. And they're chanting Ghent because, like I said earlier, Ghent had risen up in rebellion again. And so kind of Ghent has become a bit of a watchword for urban power and revolt against the aristocracy. And so, you know, the Ghent War is kind of going on. Philip says, hey, we should probably intervene in this. But the rest of the royal council doesn't really want to. Louis of Mala, the Count of Flanders, he's had some flirtations with the English. He wasn't a super well-liked figure in Paris by basically everyone except for Philip the Bold. So the rest of the royal council says, no, we're just going to let him be for now.
I mean, he's absolutely useless as the Count of Flanders.
I will say, I think his reputation does get maligned a bit. Being Count of Flanders in this time and place was a very delicate balancing act. And if you ignore like the last few years of his reign, he does a pretty good job. Things do kind of go to, things go downhill, I should say. Things go to shit in 1381 when a more radical faction takes charge in Ghent. Ooh. And you're saying, I thought the radical faction was already in charge in Ghent. And so this is an even more radical, even more militant faction. And this was led by Philip von Artevelde, who was the son of Jacob von Artevelde. In 1382, Louis is stationed at Bruges with his army. And there's a local festival. People are getting drunk. People are partying. You know, the watch isn't quite as vigilant as it should be. So the Ghent militia goes out and surprises Louis and destroys his army. He runs out of Flanders, and then they go burn down the castle of Mala. I've been calling him Louis of Mala. That was his favorite castle. They burn it down. They literally destroy the crib that he slept in as a baby.
Oh.
So he runs out of Flanders, and he runs to Artois. And he, while he's in Artois, he learns that his mother, Margaret of Other Burgundy, died. And so now he's the Count of Artois. So, you know, it's nice to have more land, but it's been a very trying time for Louis. So between the radicals chanting, Ghent, let's go Ghent, and Louis of Mala's situation deteriorating so rapidly, the royal council agrees, okay, maybe it's time for some intervention into Flanders. Philip has managed to convince the royal council to lead an expedition into Flanders. There's a few other things going on in France at the time. The situation in Brittany is kind of unstable at the moment.
Brittany's had a civil war that's been going on for ages that has just been England's excuse to just put troops there.
Yeah. So that was basically what a lot of the other people were saying. Like, let's ignore Flanders. Let's go to Brittany. But finally, Philip and Charles lead the army, and the army is actually being led by the new constable of France, Olivier de Clisson, who is a Breton noble himself and was one of the big people pushing for intervention into Brittany. But he leads them into Flanders, and the French army end up facing the Flemish in the Battle of Rosebecque. This is not a repeat of the Battle of the Golden Spurs. The Flemish militia basically get whooped. A whole bunch of them die. The Ghent War is not technically over. It will go on for a few more years. But Ghent lost a bunch of military power, lost some of their control over Flanders. So Louis is back in charge in Flanders for the most part now. But in the aftermath, the French kind of go around looting a bunch of nearby towns in Flanders. Louis tries to get them to stop, but again, he's not the most well-liked person in the French court. So they say, nah, you know, we came all the way here. We're getting some booty. And that booty includes all of the spurs that were seized in the aftermath of the Battle of the Golden Spurs. So they were taken back from the cathedral at the city of Courtrai.
And the Battle of the Golden Spurs, if you remember, Eliza, back to Philip the Fourth, so Philip the Fair, the Pope's lapper. This was like his one major defeat in an otherwise very successful reign. So they've, you know, they've won back some lost honor, I suppose.
The Battle of Rosebecque is a huge win for Philip because he basically uses French resources to secure his own inheritance. And he gets that inheritance a few years later in 1384. Battle of Rosebecque was 1382. 2 years later, Louis of Mala dies, and Philip, notably through his wife, not in his own right, but through his wife, he becomes Count of Flanders, Count of Artois, Count of Burgundy, other Burgundy, Count of Nevers, and Count of Rethel.
Damn, he's powerful.
He's getting a lot of weird sideways inheritances that just
fall
into his lap.
Very conveniently lead to him ruling a lot of stuff.
Oh, he sure does. I mean, if Philip of Roof had lived longer, he was actually the first match for Margaret of Flanders. But, you know, he died before they could actually get married. But he was not only Duke of Burgundy, he was also, like, I think, Duke of Auvergne, of Boulogne, and a few others. So that would have been a huge kind of political union there. Not that this isn't, but would have been even bigger. But all that to say, Philip the Bold is now Count of Flanders. He's Count of a whole bunch of other places too, but Flanders is the most important. The war will go on for another year, but Ghent is isolated, they're exhausted. And, you know, the nice thing about a new count coming along is that, you know, they had all this bad blood between them and Louis of Mala. Philip agrees to pardon Ghent and confirm their town privileges, something which he had done for all of the towns in Flanders except for Ghent at that point.
Oh.
And in exchange, Ghent will lay down their arms and renounce their alliance with England. So 1385, big year for Philip, and also for another reason. Because also in 1385, Philip arranges an alliance with the regent of the nearby counties of Hainaut, Holland, and Zeeland, who is Albert of Bavaria, as well as the duchess of the nearby duchy of Brabant, who is Joan. So all of these lands, Flanders, Artois, Hainaut, Holland, Zeeland, and Brabant, are all in the Low Countries. Basically modern-day Belgium and the Netherlands, they're kind of tucked together. Partially in France, partially in the Empire, relatively small but decently rich counties that the Empire, France, and England all want a piece of.
They all want those clogs.
Yeah.
So clogs are great. Yeah. And those windmills. Who wouldn't want those windmills?
It's a very desirable swamp.
It really is.
Very rich, very urbanized, and full of people willing to rise up.
Because, I mean, and the reason they rise up is because they're like, we have all this wealth.
Mm-hmm. We have all these clogs.
So, so back to Philip's alliance.
Sorry, I just love clogs.
That's the serious history.
Although I will say, Philip's love of clogs appears to have been a fan of those. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of them, but these like really long, pointy shoes.
Oh,
they're all the rage.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting what they're called, but they have a special name.
I cannot remember it either.
Yeah, elf shoes. No, like elf shoes, only they don't do like the curly up.
Sometimes they do.
They sort of droop at the end.
Some of them do,
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they curl up.
And they can go for like a foot or two. Yeah.
A lot of the times when you see them in pictures, it's like, it's twice the size of a regular foot and it kind of just droops. Kind of like Grinch feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, enough about shoes.
So those were fancy dress shoes. Philip would have worn them at the occasion that sealed this alliance, and get ready because there's going to be
great segue.
There's going to be a few more Margarets coming up.
Oh god. Yeah. Okay.
Brace so himself. Philip's oldest son John married Albert's daughter Margaret of Bavaria, and Philip's daughter Margaret of Burgundy married Albert's oldest son William. This double wedding took place in 1385 at the Cathedral at Cambrai. It was basically the event of the season. Philip even borrowed some of Charles VI's crown jewels to really deck himself out.
Yeah.
It was a super expensive affair, very elegant. Essentially, all of the French high nobility was there, a ton of important nobles from the Low Countries and the Empire were there. And it basically created this Burgundian-led alliance in the Low Countries. This alliance will become very important in the episode on John the Fearless. And even more important during the reign of his son, Philip the Good. But I guess I'll just let you guys cover that whenever you get to it.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to be returning to talk about
John. I will, yeah.
So. Ooh.
Yeah.
Never heard of him.
We'll get to that.
But I'm interested.
He's basically Philip's son.
Oh.
Yeah. But we will definitely get to him.
Oh, yeah. The double wedding between Philip's children and Albert's children is not the only Valois-Burgundian marriage to happen around this time. Because Elizabeth of Bavaria, also known more commonly as Isabeau of Bavaria, is going to be the new Queen of France.
Ooh.
Isabeau was either the first or second cousin, I don't remember off the top of my head, of William and Margaret of Bavaria. And so that kind of just ties the Bavarian Valois families closer together. She will be also a very important person, and you are having more people on to talk about her. So I won't get as much into her at the time.
Yeah. We're going to get Queen's Podcast to come talk about Isabeau. Now Philip's got like a chess piece, basically, in the royal court because he's got Isabeau. She's kind of meant to be sort of his creature as the Queen of France. But as we will see,
creature,
things might change a little bit. At this stage, you know, things generally for France are looking pretty good. Nice. So good that the Hundred Years' War looks like it might only be a 50 Years' War. Because England is in a bit of a shambles. Mm. If we just want to do a brief, very brief side note on England. We're in the sort of getting to the darker days of Richard II's reign.
Oh.
The young Richard II. He is like Charles VI. He's a young king. Mm. He's a bit older than Charles VI, but poor little Richard is like, he's very pro peace and he's trying to finish the war like peacefully, but he's got all of these, you know, uncles, cousins, nobles that are pro war. They want to go to France, do some chevauchés, prove that they're, you know, they've got the biggest balls or whatever. And we don't have much time to get into it, but just so you know, England's in a bit of a shambles because of the internal conflicts that you can definitely hear about if you listen to Rex Factor or any of the 1,000 podcasts on English history. So just know that England is not in great shape.
Yeah.
And in France, there were collective plans, which are spearheaded by Philip, to invade England.
There's even a giant wooden fort that gets assembled that is put into pieces with the intent on landing on the shores of England and making like the first French outpost.
Oh wow, they're really gonna do
it. Which is really cool. Yeah, so Philip's amassed all of this land in a very short space of time. He's inherited a bunch of crap, and he's sort of combining that with the French royal domain now that he's regent as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a really formidable territory that can easily crush England when it's, you know, assuming it remains unified and stable.
Yeah.
So the attack on England was meant to be led by Jean de Vienne, the admiral that has been around for a while. And he would go aid Scotland and attack Durham. And meanwhile, Olivier de Clisson, the Breton marshal, he's going to launch a direct invasion fleet to go down the Thames to London.
But
unfortunately, only Vienne's smaller force going to Durham managed to actually leave and ended up not doing that much damage.
Bad weather?
Because partly bad weather, yeah. But also partly Flanders, because Clisson ended up having to deal with
stupid
another smaller revolt in Flanders. So,
and then they tried this again the next year, but then this time the invasion doesn't get launched because John, the Duke of Berry, is late.
We're going to cover Barry. Yeah, whenever you bring up Barry, just imagine Barry is like the fat, jolly uncle.
Aww,
that's exactly how I imagine him.
Is kind of important as a political figure, but is also kind of useless.
Does he do gardening in his part-time? Like, pastime, I mean?
He's more into books, but we'll get to that. He's a bit of a book
grows. Word.
He's caught that.
I bet you he grows some little cacti.
So the failure to invade England led France to seek peace terms instead. And there's a big arduous conference at Leulingen, which is near Calais.
Yeah.
Why and did Philip they the have to do peace talk when they didn't even have the invasion?
Well, I mean, the war is still going on.
Oh, right.
It kind of goes for 100 years, Eliza.
Yeah, but
Philip the Bold does end up leading a lot of the negotiations at Leulingen. And he will do so over the next several years.
So meanwhile, in 1386, back to Louis, the king's brother, who I'm supposed to be talking about, he's finally an adult.
Woo!
And he's kind of moving up in the world. So he's made Duke of Touraine at this point in 1386, as well as the Count of Valois. I'm just getting to it. So 3 years later, he marries Valentina Visconti.
Nice.
Who is an Italian, sexy Italian coming over.
Nice.
She's the daughter of the Duke of Milan.
Oh.
And Louis's also very close to his brother, as I mentioned. So Charles VI, at this point, he's like heaping honors and titles upon his brother. It looks like Louis's going to develop as a bit of a challenger to Philip's very much established rule at this point.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah.
But Philip, you know, in 1387, he's saying, I'm going to be in charge forever.
Mwahaha.
I mentioned the Burgundian, Bavarian, Brabantine alliance earlier. Mm-hmm. And part of the opposition to that came from this guy, William, who is the Duke of Helders. His father was the Duke of Jülich, and they had formed an alliance alongside the Duke of Luxembourg, who is also the King of Germany.
Nice.
And so they kind of wanted to oppose the growing power of the French-led alliance. Now, this wasn't just because they wanted to oppose the Dukes of Burgundy. Helders and Brabant had basically been in an on-again, off-again war for years at this point. So once again, Philip wants to intervene in Brabant because he's also trying to secure Brabant for his family. The Duchess of Brabant, Joan, is his wife Margaret's aunt, and she has no children. So he's trying to get Burgundian hooks into Brabant. And so, like with the Ghent War, Philip is...
I'll get it.
Yeah. Philip is pushing for French intervention into Helders. But there's even more pushback against this than there was for intervention into Flanders. Because Helders, it's not like far away, but it's not in France. It's not on the borders of France. It's like, it's a ways away. But Philip wins out in the end because William, Duke of Helders, sent an insulting letter to King Charles VI. He had allied himself with the English and basically said, Charles, you are not the true King of France. The King of England is the King of France. Whole bunch of other insults. Gets Charles's blood boiling. And, you know, he's a teenager. He wants to do some fighting. He says, let's go to Helders.
Let's destroy them.
And so Philip, he not only gets this march into Helders, he also says, you know what? Let's not go through my territories and let's not go through Brabant. Let's go through the Arden Forest and take the long way around because I don't want a French army marauding through allied territories, basically.
Okay.
And so there's more pushback to this, but he gets his way in the end. When they reach Helders, the Duke kind of just hides in his castles and refuses to do battle. The French have this massive army, and he does not want to deal with it. A peace deal does get signed. That peace is beneficial to France and very beneficial to Brabant, but no glory, no booty was won in the campaign. And then the French army marches all the way back through the Ardennes. So Philip had, you know, come ahead. He used French resources to secure an inheritance once again. But there were a lot of people at court that were not a huge fan of Philip doing this. And they said, Charles VI, you are 20 years old. Like, why are you still taking, taking orders from your uncles?
And one of the people saying this is Louis of Orléans, who's like, well, Louis of not Orléans yet, but Louis of Touraine, who is like younger than Charles and being like, hey, hey.
Yeah, I believe he's 16 at that point.
An adult by the standards of the time, though. So yeah, this brings us to 1388. So in November 1388, the Marmosets, the monkeys, the old advisors from Charles V's day. No. They take over. They come back.
Okay, cool.
They make their comeback. Nice. This is when that happens. This is when the Marmosets come into being, I suppose.
The rise of the Marmosets.
And they seize power from the three. The uncles are still there as like advisors, but
that's all.
They're no longer in control of the government.
They receive gifts gracefully rather than demanding gifts.
Yes. So then Charles VI is like, I'm the full king now. Excellent.
Woohoo.
I'm going to do some more. And he decides to invade Brittany, partly because, you know, it's time that France asserts itself in Brittany, because the English have just been running a bit wild there, but also because of the attempted assassination of Olivier de Clisson, the Breton...
Ooh. Constable of France.
The Constable of France, yeah, the Marshal, the lead military. Yeah.
Because of the Breton War of Succession, there were basically two big factions in the duchy. The Pontiev faction, which was generally a bit more pro-French, and the Montfort faction, which was more pro-English. The Montforts had ended up winning, but there was still an uneasy peace. And so de Clisson, he started out his career as part of the Montfort faction, but then he switched sides to the Pontievs. Ooh. He and the Duke of Brittany absolutely hated each other. And in 1382, because of some affairs at court, possibly because Louis of Orléans was trying to seduce a woman and this one knight told his wife about it, Louis convinced his brother to send that knight away. So that knight fled to Brittany. And in Brittany, the Duke of Brittany told the knight, you know, it was really de Clisson who was behind your exile. So he came back, tried to assassinate de Clisson. That failed, and then he fled back to the Duke of Brittany. And so Charles says, you know what, screw it, we're dealing with you now, and launches a punitive expedition against Brittany. This was motivated in part for, you know, reasons of state, you know, trying to reassert some more royal authority onto Brittany, which has always been a very independent-minded duchy, but also to kind of move against the English. But the real meat of it was, this is a personal vendetta being settled by state funds, something that we have already seen Philip the Bold do twice.
Mm. Yeah. So it's during this march to Brittany that we get the first psychotic episode.
Yeah, on the march to Brittany, there's this beggar that comes up to the king and he's like, you're being betrayed, you're being betrayed. And so he's shooed away. And then, you know, they're riding a bit further. It's hot out. He's been ill for a while, and his doctors did not want him going to Brittany, but, you know, he's the king, so they can't tell him what to do. And then, basically, one of his pages drops a spear, and it clangs against someone's helmet. And it's, the sound of, like, a weapon hitting armor that kind of just shocks Charles into this episode.
Oh, yeah.
So all of a sudden, he doesn't recognize anyone. He thinks he's surrounded by enemies. He thinks he's in danger. Oh. So he runs around and kills a few men because no one really wants to
stop him.
Hurt the king. Yeah. He gets tired. He's restrained. And Philip sees this opportunity to take control of the army. He sends a letter to the Duke of Brittany, who he's always had a very good relationship with. And, you know, a peace between France and Brittany is made. And then he and Barry work to remove the Marmosets from power. Louis has basically made a lot of allies with the Marmosets. And so this is kind of bad for his political position. But, you know, he's the brother of the king. He can't be removed from power. And now he has the Duchy of Orléans.
Yeah, so Louis, meanwhile, he's just been promoted to Duke of Orléans, once again, exchanging it for Touraine. No one wants Touraine. So even though the Marmosets are gone, he's still, you know, he's still in power, and he's now sort of considered, you know, equal rank to the uncles. But this, you know, puts him in direct competition with Philip. So Louis does continue having influence, however, mainly because of his close relationship with his sister-in-law, Queen Isabeau, which sparks certain rumors that we will get to about the two of them. The psychosis with Charles VI, it doesn't actually last very long, the first one, I don't think. Louis's power kind of seems to rise when Charles is in his lucid states, because the two of them have a really good relationship. But then as soon as, you know, he goes into his quote-unquote absences, Philip seems to seize power again. Because he just generally has more authority with the nobles.
You know, yeah, he's older. He's been building up relationships with nobles over decades. He just has this kind of natural, I don't know if it's necessarily charisma, but, you know, sway. This natural, sway over people.
But yeah, Louis, Louis still got this idea that, like, eventually he's going to be a king somewhere else. He uses a lot of his clout to convince his brother, the king, to support him on a campaign to Italy because he wants to press his wife's claim to Milan, and he wants to sort of carve out a kingdom for himself. But the Pope sees this happening, and the Pope is like, no.
Like,
no. So, I mean, cutting a long story short, in 1391, the Pope makes the King of France back down by threatening to endorse an English attack on France if Louis doesn't stop, like, drop his claim. So Louis does end up backing down. But meanwhile in France, Louis's popularity is taking a bit of a downward turn because when he is in power, he proves to be just as greedy and money-grubbing as the uncles that he criticizes. And also because of his rather lustful reputation, including his alleged affair with the queen, which we'll get to in Ulala. Ooh. But the most scandalous event that Louis of Orleans becomes involved with is an event called the Bal des Ardents, or the Ball of the Burning Men.
Yes, I know.
On the 28th of January, 1393, an entertainment is organized. Grand court spectacles and entertainments were seen as by the king's doctors as a good way for him to let off steam and for him to, you know, have fun, and we're seeing it as a good remedy for his mental health. This particular ball was centered on a bunch of men of the court, including the king, getting dressed up as quote-unquote savages, which for some reason means they cover themselves in tar and leaves, and they act wild and
good fun.
Just, yeah, cause mischief.
But they had a rule.
But yes, what was the rule, Eliza?
No fire!
No fire.
Open fire.
A good
no
rule.
Open flame. A very good rule. Not a rule that Louis of Orléans followed, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately he seemed to mishear that and heard, bring fire!
So he comes in with a torch. He's really into the spectacle. He wants to get a closer look and accidentally sets fire.
He might have been drunk.
He accidentally stumbles
and trips.
He was definitely
landing
drunk
on a person.
He doesn't stumble a trip, he just gets too close to one of them, and then the flame kind of jumps onto him. This guy starts running around like crazy, sets a bunch of other guys on fire.
Everything.
Yeah, and one of the people who catches fire is the king.
But no, he dives under the dress.
Yeah, so the Duchess of Berry, so Berry's wife, actually, she has this giant dress, because it was the fashion of the time to have giant dresses. She,
which was,
you know,
great
throws,
for the king.
Yeah, she throws her dress onto the king. But, so
like,
the king is relatively unscathed, but the rest of the men...
A little burns.
The rest of the men pretty much die. Immediately or, like, succumbing to injuries later. And I can't remember, what's the exact number that dies?
I think there were eight total dancers.
Yeah.
Six of them got set on fire, and everyone who was set on fire died. Charles was protected by the skirt, and then one of the other ones, I think, jumped into a vat of wine.
Ah, yes, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. God, I can just imagine, like, the Duchess being like, quick, sire, get under my skirts!
Yeah, so the Bal des Ardents, it's this big event that is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of Charles VI's mental health.
Yeah,
and
we're
going to refer back to
relaxed.
It. Yeah, and we're going to refer back to it in future episodes as like a big moment.
A catalyst.
But this event not only destroys Charles VI's mental state, but also turns public opinion against Louis of Orléans. Yeah, and this is part of how, in this instance at least, Philip gains power over Louis. Meanwhile, Louis's wife, Valentina, is also very unpopular. She becomes an object of suspicion because on top of her being foreign, many suspected her of bewitching King Charles. Because while Charles was in these periods of madness...
What, she could only calm him?
Well, he seemed to suddenly hate the queen and love Valentina. Which the queen wasn't very happy with.
Yeah.
And it kind of adds a further complication to this weird love square that's going on between the king, his brother, and their wives. Valentina, like, eventually everyone in Paris hates her, like both nobles and the people. Eventually the pressure leads to her just leaving permanently, leaving court.
Yeah.
Possibly like ordered away by the queen because she's trying to have influence, and it's a bit difficult when this Italian temptress is around being all pretty. Valentina ends up going away and raising Louis's children in the country, which doesn't help him trying to secure his dynasty and their power in Paris.
So while that's all going on, Philip has also been at Lullingham trying to negotiate with the English. And in 1396, the Truce of Lullingham is signed, which does officially put a pause on the Hundred Years' War. I would give most of the credit to Philip, but some credit should go to the Marmosets as well, because they were also big advocates of peace while they were in charge. The truce was set to last 28 years. Spoiler alert, it will not. But again, that's a story for another day. Another term of the peace was that Richard II would marry a French princess, although the French had learned from the last time that that had happened. And in the truce was an explicit statement that any children that Richard and Isabella of France had would be barred from inheriting the French throne. Yep. And then also in 1396, Philip sent his son John to the Kingdom of Hungary to help Sigismund of Luxembourg, who we dealt with a little bit earlier, because he was facing down the Ottoman Turks, who were just, you know, on the rise right now. They're doing great. They're expanding. And so John leads what is now known as the Nicopolis Crusade. We'll talk about it probably a little bit more in the John the Fearless episode. Yeah. And if people want to go into it in more detail, I do have a 3-part miniseries on it.
Yeah, plug that miniseries.
But yeah, the crusade didn't really accomplish too much militarily, but just having a Burgundian-led crusade did bring a lot of prestige to Philip and the House of Valois-Burgundy.
Yeah, as we've seen with previous crusades, it doesn't matter if your crusade is a horrible failure. Louis the Ninth. It's the fact that you did it. It's the fact that you tried.
So throughout the 1390s, Louis kind of begins to rebuild his power, and Philip and Louis are feuding more and more. Mm-hmm. At this point, Philip gets his way most of the time, but Louis is becoming a better political operator. And like we said earlier, he wins more whenever Charles has his wits about him. In 1399, a wave of the plague struck Paris, and Philip returned to his own territories while Louis and Charles went to Rouen together. And so this is really considered the big turning point when Louis really starts to gain a hold on French politics.
Yeah. And this brings us to the 1400s. We've entered the 1400s now. We're in the 15th century, which feels honestly like modern for this podcast, which has spent so long in the deep dark ages. The rivalry, between the dukes, it doesn't go away with Louis getting more power. It just escalates more and more the more power he gets. And meanwhile, England is very keen to exploit this. So Richard II has just been deposed by his cousin Henry IV, who becomes the first Lancaster King of England.
Yeah.
So we're getting nearish to the Wars of the Roses, but that's, a couple of generations away still. But yeah, Philip the Bold, he left power. He left Paris, I should say, for an extended period. And while he was gone, Louis sort of worked to exclude him. And he appointed, several people who were his people in the right spots in government. And it becomes clear that, if Philip wants to get power, he might have to do it with more than friendly means.
So, as things are kind of turning against Philip, he is in the Low Countries getting ready to marry one of his other younger sons to one of his, to the daughter of one of his more important vassals. Hmm. So, it's late 1401, and Philip decides that he's got to escalate things a little bit. It's time to march back to Paris in force. So he brings a small army, and there is a standoff that kind of ensues for a little bit.
What's his definition of small army?
I believe 800 soldiers is the number, but I don't know for sure off the top of my head. So Philip has soldiers in Paris. Louis has soldiers in Paris. Their respective kind of hotels, their castles kind of get a bit more fortified. But in the end, they don't resort to violence. They ended up negotiating a settlement. There is reason to believe that Philip never intended to spark a civil war. Yeah. He just wanted to force Louis into a settlement. With an official negotiated settlement, he might be able to limit Louis's power, because Louis's power seemed to be on the rise. While Philip, you know, he's starting to get a bit older. And, you know, he knows that when his son takes over, like, his son is not the son of a king.
Yeah.
So he will have less inherent power. And so even though a civil war doesn't break out in 1401 or 1402, the fact that two princes of the fleur-de-lis were willing to resort to arms to secure their positions, it was a troubling sign for the future, and we will see this happen time and time again in the near future.
Yeah.
In the aftermath, there's a whole bunch of fighting over who would be regent. And so I said I quoted Sumption earlier with kind of, there wasn't really a regent. And so throughout the late 1390s and early 1400s, there's just a flurry of ordinances coming from the king and the royal council. And so the regency is not for Charles VI and his mental illness. But if he were to die with a young heir, there would need to be some sort of regency arrangement. But if there were to be a regent named for the young king, then that person would have a pretty reasonable claim to power while Charles was absent. And if there was to be a single regent named, it would definitely be Louis of Orléans, because he was the only male side uncle of the future king.
Whereas when the future king becomes king, Philip would be great uncle. He'd be further away.
So Philip the Bold, he doesn't want a single regent. He wants a regency council, because that would basically continue the power struggle between Burgundy and Orléans.
Because guess who's on the council?
Burgundy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, even when, like, Louis is also saying, okay, we can do a council, there's still a lot of, like, fighting about the details. Like, how big is this council going to be? How many Burgundians are going to be on it? How many Orleanists?
So many details.
Will the queen have power over the council? How many royal officers will be on the council? How many princes will be on the council? Like, how will power be divided? Are there going to be subcommittees? Stuff like that. So nothing really ends up being decided. Basically, at the end of all of this, the royal council will just continue to rule if there's a minor king. But the tension breaks in the spring of 1404, because Philip the Bold is in Brabant once more trying to secure his succession to the duchy. He gets very, very close, but he falls ill before the deal could be sealed. He decides to return to Flanders as a testament to both how ill he was and how wealthy and powerful he was. On the way back, he hired people to basically smooth the road in front of his carriage so he would have a more comfortable ride.
Okay, I feel so I would do that if I was that wealthy and I was sick.
I mean, I get it. I feel like bumpy carriage ride does not sound fun if you're feeling nauseous.
Oh, no.
But the smooth ride was not enough, and he died on the 27th of April, 1404, not in Burgundy or Flanders, but in the Brabantine city of Halle, in the Inn of the Stag. He was succeeded by his son, John the Fearless.
How old was he?
Philip, I want to say is 62.
Okay, cool.
So he's not like super old, but he's not a young man anymore. Yeah. And so, yeah, John the Fearless becomes Duke of Burgundy, Count of Burgundy, and Count of Flanders. And then his younger son, Anthony, will become the Duke of Brabant.
Mm.
All right. Now my guy is just alive. So the rest of this will just be about Louis. Obviously, Josh will be returning to talk about John the Fearless, the next Duke of Burgundy.
I'll be back.
But basically, from Philip's death, I'm just going to kind of summarize what happens between Louis and John the Fearless from this point, because it's, I mean, it's a lot of back and forth of them fighting, the king forcing them to to shake hands, them fighting again, and it becomes worse because John the Fearless is not Philip of Burgundy. John the Fearless is...
He's ruthless.
He's more kind of rash, impetuous, ruthless, and he's definitely quicker to rise to when, you know, Louis kind of baits him.
Short fuse.
Yeah. Whereas Philip of Burgundy was very sort of patient.
And, patient.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so I'll just get a brief summary. John the Fearless manages to kidnap the royal children.
Whoa! Damn that Fearless!
After Orleon previously also tried kidnapping them. Because if you control the royal children, you know, you control the succession, and that's very important. And everyone at this point thinks that Charles VI won't be long for this world.
He's going to go at any second.
Spoiler alert, he hangs on for another 20 shocking years or something.
Amount of time, but considering how young
which, shocking amount of time.
Which is like, I'm like, I know, which I feel sorry for him.
I feel so sorry for him. But illness. Yeah, it's quite grim. But yeah, so John the Fearless, because he's kidnapped the royal family, he manages to force Charles VI to sign a royal decree to make him regent and the guardian of the Dauphin. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Orleans uses funds that were supposed to be used to recapture Calais and help end the Hundred Years' War. He has to redirect these funds to try to sabotage John the Fearless's regency. And to add insult to injury, there were allegations that Orleans had also forced himself on John the Fearless's wife, Margaret of Bavaria. So this, you know, just make things worse. The Duke of Berry, the remaining uncle, manages to sort of mediate and prevent the cousins from breaking into complete civil war. But eventually, something has to give.
He does.
It's going to explode in the true crime event of the 14th century.
One of the biggest scandals to ever rock France.
I'm excited.
But yeah, this is possible. This is
I'm so excited.
Up there is like one of the biggest ooh la la events that we're ever going to talk about.
Oh my god, that makes me so excited.
So this is an amazing event because of the primary source account we have on it. Essentially, it's a kind of police report from the year 1407.
Oh my god! Yes.
The whole thing was like discovered on a scroll in like the 1600s, about 250 years later. So it includes a transcribed first-hand account from Jacquette Griffard, who was a cobbler's wife, who witnessed a murder on the streets of Paris in the middle of the night. So she's sort of looking down from a window, upper window of her house, and I can actually quote this middle-class French woman. So she says, "I saw the great lord on his knees in the middle of the street." This is Orléans. "In front of the door of the house of Marshal Rieux. His head was bare, and he was surrounded by 7 or 8 men. They all had masks. I couldn't see their faces, and they were holding swords and axes. I couldn't see the horses anymore. The men began striking the lord with their weapons. He raised his arm once or twice over his head, saying, 'What is this? What are you doing?' No one answered." So this is Louis of Orléans. He's dressed kind of casually after an evening at the Queen's Palace.
Fun and merriment.
A not at all suspicious evening at the Queen's Palace. And the men who murder him...
They were 100% ordered by John the Fearless.
They were 100%. Based on what happens later, which we'll get to in John the Fearless' episode. Basically, he claims credit for this murder. Yeah. So back to Jacquette's account. She says, "Soon the lord fell down in the street and lay there, while the men kept hitting him with their swords, cut and thrust as hard as they could, as if they were beating an old mattress. I yelled out as loudly as I could, 'Murder, murder!' One of the men in the street looked up and shouted, 'Shut up, you damned woman, shut up!'" So that's the count. That's part of the most important part of the account from Jacquette. So Louis was just then abandoned. He was left by his assailants with one of his hands cut off and his brains spilled out onto the cobblestones. We'll get into the consequences of this for John the Fearless, obviously, in a future episode. That's the end of both our regents' lives. So for now, we'll just leave it there.
Damn.
Yeah.
That was so scandally!
I know. It's a big bang at the end. So Louis of Orléans, in contrast to the elderly Philip of Burgundy, was only 35 when he died. So his heartbroken and sickly wife, Valentina, died a year later. And that left their three young sons as orphans. And they had a daughter as well.
How many years had Philip died before that?
Three.
Oh, wow.
So it did not take long for John to reach drastic, to take drastic measures.
We're, in a future episode, going to be covering Louis's son, Charles of Orléans, as he rises to seek his revenge.
Revenge.
I love a
bit of revenge.
So, revenge. With all of that biography stuff out of the way, it's time to get into Enchanté.
Ooh, can I do the whisper?
You are most welcome to do the whisper.
Enchanté.
So I'll share with you a portrait of Philip of Burgundy, first of all, which is apparently based on a contemporary original, but this is actually a copy from later on in like the 16th century.
It was like the grandpa, and they got the beanie, and like he's gone out for a winter's walk.
He does have a nice hat.
I love this hat. I love this hat.
This is an early morning walk outfit, and he's got his warm woolly hat on with his woolly scarf.
He's got the most French nose and mouth and eyes that I've ever seen.
I know. I thought that.
He is a son of the King of France, after all.
His face is like shaped like a croissant. Yeah, so Josh, do you want to get into the Enchanté, the positives?
Yeah, so apart from just the portrait of him, he was a big patron of the arts. Architectural feats kind of, I think, are the most impressive, especially his kind of tomb and mausoleum, which is the Charterhouse of Champmol, which was a Carthusian monastery that he built basically as a way to compete with Saint-Denis.
Oh.
He hired some really talented and important artists of the time, such as Klaus Luther, Jan Malville, who were like respectively the most important like sculptor and painter of the day to decorate his tomb.
Yeah.
And so I do recommend at a later time looking up the sculptures that are there, because they are very impressive. But he was also a patron of a bunch of other Low Country artists, which include the Limburg brothers, who are most famous for their Très Richesseurs of the Duke of Berry, which you'll probably cover when you cover the Duke of Berry. He also owned a ton of tapestries, because Artois was like the center of tapestry production at the time, and he was the Count of Artois. And then also something that's pretty cool is that he had this castle at Edon, which was filled with these automata, or I think the French is like engins de bêtement, which is like engines of amusement. Ooh. And so they're all of these kind of, I guess, pranks, really. Like, they'll blow water on you. You can, like, make your voice appear from another part of the room. There are trap doors, which will, like, have your guests fall into a bed of feathers. Stuff like that.
That is so fun.
And so he did not build all of that, but he did start a restoration of the castle. Philip was also a big patron of the writer Christine de Pizan. Louis was too, so we do have to count it for both of them, admittedly. But Philip commissioned several works from her, including a biography on Charles V.
It seems to me the one thing that everyone can agree on in this time is that Christine de Pizan rocks.
I know, right?
Everyone patronizes her from both sides of the aisle, and she's like kind of politically immune. It's kind of amazing.
It sure is. I'm actually working on an episode right now, kind of looking at Christine de Pizan's political thought throughout the Civil War, and it's been pretty interesting.
Oh, amazing. We need to trade notes, because we're eventually going to do a Patreon on Christine de Pizan.
Philip also patronized a number of other writers, and he also dabbled in poetry himself. So him and the Duke of Bourbon started something called a Court of Love, which is basically a mock court where people just write love poetry, and instead of debating matters of state, you're like debating the merits of the poetry.
Yeah, Eleanor of Aquitaine started this.
Yes, she is probably the most famous person associated with them, but they've been done throughout the Middle Ages, and Philip did start one as well.
Moving on to Louis Enchanté, I've got an image of him. There are a few, he doesn't have like a portrait, but there are a few images of him that I had to pick from. I chose the one where he looks the cutest, although it's a bit ominous. So this is a death-threatening Louis of Orléans on his knees. As he kind of seems to be like reciting poetry to a tree or something.
Like an orange tree.
It's a very interesting painting. This is a wall painting from the Convent of the Celestines in Paris. And this was commissioned by certain descendants of Louis who may or may not become kings of France. But we'll get to that when we get to that. Mm-hmm. So Louis of Orléans, his reputation definitely took a major hit immediately after his death. So his name ends up being dragged through the mud by the Burgundians, and even people on his side are like, he made a lot of mistakes. A lot of this was to kind of justify the idea that Louis had been murdered, and that it wasn't really a murder. We were saving France from this horrible guy who, you know, set people on fire at the Bal des Ardents and seduce the queen, all this sort of thing. His reputation does kind of later get salvaged a bit. He continues to be like an object of slander throughout like the Renaissance and the Revolutionary period.
Especially in the Revolutionary period, actually. One of the things that I found in my research on Burgundian propaganda is that a lot of the historians inspired by the French Revolution just kind of took that propaganda at face value because it fit into kind of their own idea of a corrupt, aristocratic, and greedy figure, whereas Burgundy like always made sure to represent himself as a champion of the people.
But, you know, in the later 19th, sort of early 20th century, his reputation kind of gets a bit salvaged. People start to see him as more of like a romantic hero, kind of like a lover, not a fighter kind of guy, who's just kind of looking out for his brother, who's being manipulated by these uncles. And he's like boldly resisting the villainous Burgundians who are, you know, siding with the English and that kind of thing. This is definitely the take of Hella Hasse, who is a brilliant Dutch author from like the mid 20th century. She has a novel from the 1950s called In a Dark Wood Wandering, which I actually read recently. It's one of these grand historical novels, kind of in the vein of The Accursed Kings, but it's a bit less pulpy, I guess, than The Accursed Kings. It's a bit more artistic, and it's actually written by a woman, which is nice. And this kind of betrays Louis as kind of like a flawed kind of anti-hero who's like struggling with his lust, but he's also like very pious, and this is definitely accurate. Hasse did her research, but in terms of sort of material things we have left from Louis, because he doesn't have as much wealth and like time. And power and time as Philip, there's not much in the way of like these are like great castles and palaces that he commissioned. He doesn't have as much of that stuff. He's still, you know, a big like cultural influencer. He also, wrote music and poetry. He's definitely in this kind of world of courtly love and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's Enchanté.
Okay.
We've kind of compared them a bit. Eliza, it now falls to you to decide who wins this particular laurel.
Okay, so when I came into this, I thought I'd be going with Louis just because I was like, oh, he's a good brother, like, you know, to the king, blah, 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 blah. But I just prefer Philip. I just think he had a better, like, legacy in terms of, like, you know, the architecture. Like, I get he did live around a lot longer.
It did help that he wasn't murdered in his 30s.
Yeah. Yes. I think legacy-wise, like, okay, that castle sounds super cool, so that also helps Philip's case.
I have to concede that Philip kind of hands down does win this one. Also, he has a contemporary portrait, which is always a big win for Enchanté.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Not bloody praying to a tree.
That's, you know, category one, won by Philip.
Yep.
So moving on to En Garde.
En Garde. I think there's a bunch of examples of Philip going real hard for power whenever he gets it.
Yeah.
I've described Philip many times in my show as a very greedy man, both for wealth and for power.
For land.
And very much for land.
Mine.
I love when you were like, and Philip's interested in this because he wants it.
Exactly. He never stopped lusting for power and land. Time and time again, we see it. We see it with his marriage with Margaret of Flanders.
Mm.
We see it with the Battle of Rosebeck and the campaign to Flanders. We see it with the campaign to Helders. But not just land, though. He also lusted for power.
Yeah.
You know, he overturned Charles V's regency arrangements to get himself more power. He literally pushed Louis of Anjou out of the seat next to Charles VI during the coronation. He used his children to make, like, very advantageous political matches. We saw that with the double wedding at Cambrai. You know, he also tied his family closer to Bavaria by arranging for Isabeau to become Queen of France. And he also looted the French treasury with abandon. I think I read that at one point, this wasn't every year, but at the peak, he diverted, I think, a sixth of the total revenues of France to himself.
Damn.
So
which is how he manages to afford the fantastical engines.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention the Nicopolis Crusade. All of these were very expensive undertakings financed in large part from France. So yeah, he is constantly trying to gain power.
God, all I'm thinking is the seagulls and Finding Nemo going, mine.
Absolutely.
And that's him, but he's just holding like different like maps of kingdoms and like, my kingdom, mine! Yeah.
So meanwhile, Louis's definitely has a very different character. He obviously does want power, for sure. But yeah, I've got a description of his character by the writer Bart Van Loo, who is kind of contrasting him to John the Fearless. But he says, Louis was the kind of man who could dance tastefully, crack a joke with a bow, and impress the ladies with a single glance. But he could also be extremely melancholy. His outlook on the world alternated between somber and sensual. His pious disposition regularly compelled him to seek solace at the monastery of the Celestines in Paris for prayer and contemplation. As a God-fearing merrymaker with a sense of humor and an air of despondency, Louis perfectly incarnated the extremes of the late Middle Ages. So he's got this rather interesting contradictory personality, and this kind of both helped and hindered Orléans in his like relentless attempts to kind of mitigate the power of Burgundy. So on the one hand, he was very charismatic and personable, at times seemingly more so than his uncle and his cousin, John the Fearless. And he was better loved by the king himself, which is a very important thing, in the king's lucid moments, at least. But on the other hand, he was very self-sabotaging. So his career was a bit of a roller coaster. Louis struggled all the way to get to gain power over Philip. He's definitely the underdog in this situation. Yeah. But of course, what we look for on God is not just success, but also agency. And I think Louis shows just as much agency as Philip does. He's constantly pursuing his claims, like his wife's claim to Milan, which was, of course, unsuccessful. But his descendants will continue referring back to this claim, actually, as an excuse to invade and extend their influence into Italy, which is done more successfully by later generations, but Louis kind of lays the foundations for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I pretty much just have to hand on guard to Philip because
unfortunately, I know.
It's
I was thinking that too, but I was like, he like tries, but he just can't quite grasp it while Philip can usually grasp it more.
I will say though, to be fair to Louis, if he was not assassinated, he probably would have ended up being more successful than Philip.
But that's always a what if.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a what if. Eliza, technically the choice is yours, but I have technically just forfeited on guard
to Josh. And I have to agree with you. Philip's a bit more successful at being greedy.
That is two for two for Philip the Bold.
Sure is.
So moving on to Voulez-Vous, and I think this one is a bit more interesting because this is the round where we decide what they actually did for the people of France.
Yeah.
Voulez-vous.
Very nice.
Thank you. There's a lot of things that you could say that he did for himself or he did for France. There's a bit of a thin veil between what's private and what's public in this period in time. So I personally believe that Philip believed that by making himself stronger, he was making France stronger. But when you step back and look at it, it doesn't always end up that way.
Yeah.
But he did push Frenchification into the empire in both the County of Burgundy and the Low Countries. And he was also one of the biggest negotiators and advocates for peace with England. The Truce of Lullingham was not entirely his doing, but it was largely his doing. Something we didn't talk about as much was he was also big in reconciling the Montfort and Penthièvre factions in Brittany. So, you know, the War of Breton Succession left deep scars in the duchy, and while he didn't totally paper over them, he did usher in a new kind of era of peace and stability in Brittany. And
he paved the path.
Yeah.
Smoothed it out.
And all, admittedly, like a few decades later, there's some things that re-erupt in Brittany. So he wasn't 100% successful, but he did help a lot.
And if you're a Burgundian subject in this time, it's pretty good.
Yes, yeah. One of the nice things about being a subject of the Duke of Burgundy is that Philip managed to win exclusions for a lot of royal taxes in the Duchy of Burgundy. In the 1380s, there were a bunch of tax revolts, but not in Burgundy because they were not being taxed nearly as much.
So he's raiding the French treasury of like people he's technically not supposed to rule.
Yeah.
While giving his people tax breaks.
Moving away from state affairs, he also is known for banning the Gamay grape in favor of the Pinot Noir grape, which led to Burgundian wine becoming as famous as it is today.
Pinot Noir does happen to be my favorite wine, so...
And so you can thank Philip for that.
I keep wanting to hate Philip, and then I'm like, oh, but that wine, though.
It's a good wine. And then this might be a bit more of a stretch. The Northern Renaissance is generally identified with the courts of his grandson and great-grandson, Philip the Good and Charles the Bold, as well as their Habsburg successors. But he did really set the tone for, you know, the future courts of splendor. He patronized a lot of Low Country artists, like I said earlier, such as the Limburg brothers. So basically a lot of the forerunners of the Northern Renaissance were patronized by Philip, and he kind of brought them to either Dijon or Paris or just kept them around in Flanders from all across the Low Countries.
So Louis, he's kind of the opposite in this of Philip in this category. I find that, you know, Kings of France, we've done previously, with Voulez-Vous, there's like kind of two aspects to it. Things that they positively did for the people, on one hand. And on the other hand, there's like positive character. Like he was a good guy kind of thing. And I think while Philip definitely falls into the he was a bad guy, but he did good stuff for the people category, Louis's kind of the opposite. Where because of his limited influence and because he had limited time to actually do things and because there was like a civil war for the entire time that he was in power, there's not much of him doing anything except just taxing people. But he's, character-wise, seems like a guy who would be a great ruler, you know, given the chance. So, you know, he's got admirable traits, you know, he's pious, he's popular with those who know him, like he's like chivalrous, all that kind of thing. I do find him more likable than Philip, but that's probably because he's the underdog.
Did he take taxes, a lot of money from the treasury?
Yes,
he did.
God, they're useless.
A lot of it was to sort of counteract a lot of the stuff that Philip was doing. And it's in that period where basically like they're vying for control over the resources of France. If one takes money out of the treasury, the other one's going to take money out of the treasury.
Yeah.
Who would you rather live under, Eliza?
Okay, like if I was a Burgundian, I'd totally want to live under Philip. But in general, in terms of France, if I lived in other parts of France, I'm not sure I would because I'd be so pissed off that the Burgundians aren't paying as much tax as I am.
Yeah.
I'd be so peeved about that. Like, and that's like, I'd be, infuriated.
I'd love it if you just broke the format, which is like, neither of you get it.
Oh, I kind of want to do that in a way, because both of them are peeving me off. Stealing money from the treasury. Bloody hell.
I mean, depending on how the other categories do, potentially this may be a moot point, the Vulebrio category. So we could move on and come back to it.
Can I come back to it?
You may do that. So moving on to Ooh La La.
Ooh La La. Yeah, this is fun.
Let me do it in Eliza's cadence as well.
Yeah, I feel like you got to do like the breaths with it too. Yeah.
All right. Get Philip's part over with.
All right.
I want to talk about Louis' scandal. Sounds
good. Yes! So yeah, Philip, like we went over, he was a notorious looter of the French treasury. He was known to have affairs, and he acknowledged two illegitimate children.
Well, and at least acknowledged them.
Mm-hmm. And I don't, I could swear that I've read this somewhere, but I can't find a source for it when I was doing the research for it. So I might be making this up, but I'm pretty sure it's true. But it was rumored that the innkeeper at the Stag Inn where he died was one of his illegitimate children.
Ooh.
And then
maybe he was there for like a booty call with mom. Been a bit salty. As his last act.
What a way to go out. And then so a week after the French army returned from Gelders, the king was celebrating the eighth anniversary of his coronation. At the mass, the Cardinal Bishop of Laon called for Charles to dismiss his uncles and rule in his own right. A wave of supportive murmuring then spread through the cathedral, and Charles did that. However, days after this happened, the bishop was found dead, and an autopsy found evidence of poison. No evidence ever turned up linking Philip to the murder, but even at the time, there were rumors that he was involved. That's all I have for Philip, though. There's definitely some good scandals, but he was not quite the...
The best is the chair pushing.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite elements of Philip's career.
I mean, obviously, Louis also loots the French treasury, all of that. And at one point, he tried to kidnap the French royal children. But I can't remember who did it first, John the Fearless or Louis Voltaire. I think Louis tried to kidnap them.
So John,
and then John actually kidnapped them.
Yeah, John was heading to Paris, and so Louis took the children out of Paris, and then John caught up and took them back to Paris.
And speaking of children, Louis also had illegitimate children. So Froissart has this whole chapter about Louis's infatuation with a Parisian woman, which eventually leads to the war in Brittany, like tangentially.
Yeah.
But at one point in this story,
it's all her fault.
He promises this woman 1,000 gold crowns to go to bed with him.
Damn.
So yeah, that's quite scandally. Louis's only confirmed bastard is called John. And he had this child with Mariette d'Anguillon, who was the wife of King Charles's chamberlain. Ooh. And they were sort of having this affair at court while Valentina was off in the country. So she was his, like, court... She was his, like, city wife.
Pretty cool.
And as a quick aside, Mariette's husband was the first person suspected with killing Louis of Orléans.
Oh, okay, that does thicken that plot. Yeah.
He was innocent. It was John. We all know this.
So John, as in Louis's bastard son, John. He's known as the Bastard of Orléans. Valentina actually ends up raising this bastard, John, alongside her children.
That's so nice.
Yeah. So she's mother of the year. So she raises him in their like country residence with her three sons and their daughter. And this son, John, he ends up becoming the Count of Dunois. So he inherits territory from his father. And he actually played a very important role as a general in the later stages of the Hundred Years' War. He's one of the companions that fights alongside Joan of Arc. So he's going to come up again. So meanwhile, the biggest scandals for Louis were A, his assassination. Although this is more John the Fearless' scandal. But, you know, at least a point for assassination.
Coming from the Queen's chamber. Or Queen's resident.
Other biggest scandal, his role in the Bal des Ardents.
A big
setting fire and, you know, He literally set the fire that could destroy the king's sanity and see his rumored affair with Queen Isabeau. Also, the whole thing of his wife being suspected of witchcraft, that's maybe, you know, proxy scandal. And Queen's podcast, who we're going to discuss Isabeau with, they have said on their podcast that they think the accusation of infidelity between Louis and the Queen is rather unfounded. It's more of like a slandery thing that people say afterwards.
I also agree with that.
Yeah. They definitely were good. They were very good friends.
They're good chums.
And it was, you know, it was acceptable for a man and a woman of the same family to, you know, see each other regularly.
Yeah.
You know, have parties together.
They're in the same family.
Yeah, they're in the same family. They're literally, by like the Christian standards of the time, they are literally brother and sister. But the Burgundians do spread rumors that like Isabeau's children aren't even the king's. They're the king's brothers. Yeah. And this ends up being used to justify certain things later on. So that is, unless I've left anything out, that is all of Louis of Orleans' scandal. He's a scandalous dude. He's a lustful, lustful man. A lot of stuff that maybe gets blamed on him unfairly, but the fact that the scandal has stuck to him, mainly due to factors surrounding his assassination, which he definitely incurred. He's a scandalous man.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give it to him. I have to give it to Louis. Especially with the fire. That really just clinches it.
He wins.
Actually, the second I heard the fire, I just knew he was going to win it.
I was like, I don't care if Louis doesn't win this episode. If he wins the scandal, if he wins the Ulala round, I can die happy.
Yeah, he's got to win scandal.
My favorite round.
Okay, so that's two for Philip, one for Louis. So, the reason why I thought maybe Villevue might not matter is because the Vion Throne round is unfortunately out of your hands, Eliza.
Yeah.
And this is probably the deciding factor.
Yeah.
Josh, would you like to list off all of the dates of rulership for Philip?
Yeah.
By the way, in Vion Throne in this series, we're not really thinking about children because children don't really matter in terms of you being a regent. We're mainly focusing on like how long their tenure was as regent.
So he was regent semi-officially from 1380 to 1388, and then unofficially from 1392 to 1404, which is a total of 20 years. We can also add on Duke of Burgundy from 1363 to 1404, so 41 years. And Count of Flanders, Burgundy, Artois, Nevers, and Rethel from 1384 to 1404, which was 20 years.
Damn.
And I'm not going to bother saying how long Louis was in his jobs because it's definitely not as long as any of that. So Louis of Orleans was only very briefly declared, not even regent, like designated regent in case I die by Charles. So he's very much a case of, and this is going to happen a couple times in this series, where like there's going to be a guy who's very much not technically the regent, or a woman in a couple cases, but who is so big and influential and important in this period.
They basically are.
I can't not give them an episode, and that is Louis. But sadly, that doesn't reflect well in Vion Throne.
I think we can all agree that Philip was definitely helped by a certain assassination.
Yes, yeah, that is three for Philip. Only one category, the Ulala category for Louis, and an undetermined category in Villevue, but which at the end of the day doesn't fully matter. So unfortunately, Louis of Orléans is getting kicked out.
Assassinated.
He's getting kicked out of the miniseries. He will not be going through to the audience poll that we will conduct at the end of this miniseries to declare who is the regent of madness. Supreme regent of madness. Louis of Orléans, unfortunately, is out of the running, but Philip the Bold is definitely going to be up there as one of the contenders.
Yes. Amazing. You know, so Louis's sons considered John the Fearless's justification of the deed Louis's second death. So I'm going to consider this his third death.
Oh, no.
Poor chap.
You would say that, you filthy Burgundian. Thank you, Josh, for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Being the villain of the week.
I'm honestly just happy to be involved with a podcast episode that I don't have to edit myself. Good luck with this very long recording, Ben.
Oh, this is going to be a nightmare to edit.
Well, that's why I'm happy with it every time.
Yeah, imagine how Eliza feels. Free as a bird. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Josh. And we'll see you again very soon.
Yes.
As you will be returning to talk about John the Fearless. Yet another regent. And everyone go check out Josh's podcast.
Yes.
Grand Dukes of the West. It's fantastic. I've been
very, very
it's
good.
Now it's become one of my sources now that I
thank
use
you
during my research, because it's very thorough. It's a real great in-depth look at Valois Burgundian history.
And it saves Ben from researching.
Saves me from well, I still research, but you know.
No, I know, I was just joking.
I don't have to worry too much about the Burgundian stuff because someone's already done it. Yeah, and thank you for coming
thank
on.
Thank you for joining.
So that's gonna be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.
And from me as well. Oh, I should do a Dutch goodbye. Farvel. There we go. And a farvel from me.